From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Election results from the world's largest democracy show incumbent Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi with a massive and decisive victory. Modi's right-wing Hindu nationalist party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, has exceeded even its own expectations. Opposition leader Rahul Gandhi of the Congress Party conceded defeat. Religious minorities in India fear what awaits them in Modi's second term, with the Prime Minister claiming a huge mandate for pushing his domestic and foreign policy agenda. We turn now to Sameer Dosani. He is co-founder of PeaceVigil.net, a website that designs tools to promote peace. Sameer holds a master's degree in women's studies from La Trobe University, Australia, where his thesis focused on the role of religious sectarianism in undermining women's rights in India. Welcome, Sameer.
Thank you, Sonali.
So did you expect Modi to win with such a large margin? It seems as though even he didn't expect it.
Yeah, there were noises. You know, when the campaign began, I have to say that I did expect it, just because of the level of control of the BJP. The pro-BJP media is the majority of media in India. And you sort of get blasted with this right-wing messages 24 hours a day in India. So at the beginning, I did expect it. But as the campaign progressed, I saw signs of desperation from Modi and his supporters, which made me think that maybe they knew something that I didn't, and that maybe they were going to either not win or win by much less. So when the result actually came, it was a surprise. But if you had asked me when the election started a month ago, if I'd expected this outcome, I would have said, yeah, something like this.
Right. And of course, because we're talking about literally hundreds of millions of voters, the entire election process in India takes several weeks, even though counting of votes takes many, many days. We're still talking about early election results, but they seem pretty clear because he's won by such a large margin. What about the win of BJP members of parliament, of the Lok Sabha? The BJP, even in that front, Modi's party appears to have won pretty big.
Yeah, so just to be clear, these were not local elections. These were only the Lok Sabha elections that we're talking about here. And Modi's party has won in most states. There's a couple of states we can talk about that are outliers where they would have expected to do better. But overall, they've gotten the same number. In fact, I think they've gotten one more seat than they got in 2014. The coalition as a whole has pretty much the same number that they had in 2014. Voter turnout was similar. That means relatively high, about 65%. Voter turnout in India. So that's some of the higher voter turnout numbers we've seen. And what's disturbing about this election, Sonali, as opposed to the 2014 election where Modi came to power, is that in 2014, the discourse, the rhetoric was not about the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is sort of the right wing, BJP is their political arm, but they claim to be a civil organization, a social organization. But in fact, they're the base of all sort of right-wing Hindutva, we call it in India, elements. So this is the right-wing Hindu elements. So that was not the rhetoric in 2014. The rhetoric in 2014 was about development. It was about progress. But none of that development or progress really happened in the last 5 years. And so they had to sort of just go back to their roots, which is hating Muslims, Christians, Dalits, and minorities, and women. And the fact that they won on a platform of hate is extremely disturbing.
Right. And so just to explain to the audience, India's prime ministers are directly elected by voters, unlike some other parliamentary systems. And the prime minister has a five-year term. So this would be Modi's second term. And as you said, his message was quite different. Because this was a re-election campaign, presumably Modi's record and his achievements or lack thereof during the first 5 years would have been what voters might consider in re-electing him. And it seems as though on the domestic policy front, the biggest issue was India's demonetization. And on the foreign policy front was how India treated its main rival, Pakistan. So can you go through some of those and how Modi managed to spin the actuality, you know, what actually spin reality of those domestic and foreign policy agendas in his favor?
Yeah. I mean, I think here we have to talk about, like, you know, what's truth and sort of like the post-truth politics of our moment, right? So the fact is that demonetization was a disaster. By every measure, including, you know, the Modi government's own measures, it cost a significant percentage of GDP over the past.
And can you briefly explain it to the audience who aren't familiar what that was?
Sure, absolutely. So what he did in 2015, I believe, 2016, perhaps, what he did was he basically took the two largest notes. So we have the rupee in India, the two largest denominations, the two largest notes, the equivalent of a $100 bill or the $20 bill in the US. He made those illegal. Basically, he said at 8 p.m., he said, from midnight tonight, that's not going to work. You have to go to the bank in the next 3 months and exchange your notes for new notes that will come. And this was supposedly to tackle what they call black money. Black money is a concept that doesn't really exist in other countries. It's money that has been, through various means, is escaped taxation, right? So the idea was you would make these notes illegal and a certain percentage of them wouldn't come back into circulation, and therefore that would be the black money, right? So you'd have some proof. The fact is that almost all the notes came back into circulation. It wiped out the informal sector. In India, traditionally, many poor people, I wouldn't say most poor people, but many poor people are informal traders. So they're using cash, and that wiped out 80% of cash. You know, it was no longer there in terms of the notes themselves, in terms of the amount of currency. So the informal sector was completely wiped out. It has not recovered. And the result is that India's overall growth rates, which of course is something that this government cares a lot about, stalled. So you had a certain level of growth. It was already sort of slowing down in the last years of the Congress regime. So from 2012, it was slowing down. But that slowdown really went into a nosedive as a result of demonetization. And some economists, including the former chair of the Indian CBI, Raghuram Rajan, I mean, he estimates that India may have lost even more than the official figure. So he estimates it maybe as much as 10 or 12%. Of GDP growth that was lost. So that's the truth. And then you have the post-truth, which is that, I mean, Modi basically said, Modi basically is someone who does these grandiose things and spins them in his own way. And he has a lot of media, like imagine five Fox Newses, all repeating his message. So, I mean, I think at a certain point, he just stopped talking about demonetization. And when he stopped talking about demonetization, when it was proven that it was a failure, his supporters and the media and so on stopped talking about it as well, and they moved on to other issues. And those other issues, it's not clear what those were either. I mean, he claimed to be the chokidar, he claimed to be the night watchman of India. It's not clear exactly what he meant by that, because he meant he was going after corruption and these kind of things. But of course, there's no evidence that he's done any of that. So this is a lot of empty rhetoric.
And then on the foreign policy agenda, one of the most recent things that he was able to point to was a decisive Indian military action around the contested state of Kashmir in February of this year, with the latest spat with Pakistan. How did Modi essentially show himself to be tough on Pakistan, which unfortunately ended up being part of a huge part of his campaign platform, and that he won a lot of supporters who might have held the failures of demonetization against him, but may also then have rewarded him for this tough position militarily?
Yeah, so in response to an incident in which some members of the armed forces were killed, possibly by friendly fire, the Indian Air Force bombed some targets in Pakistan. They don't seem to have actually hit their targets. They don't seem to have injured or killed anyone. All we know is that some forest basically was destroyed. So, but that was spun in a way again, it's the question of what we know to be true and the way it was spun. So I suppose when you drop bombs, it's seen as this decisive action. It's seen as taking some concrete steps towards something, right? And I think, frankly, in that incident, the person who should really deserve some kudos for promoting peace is Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan, who basically refused to take the bait. He basically said, look, India is trying to goad us into more border conflicts and possibly war, and this may be related to their election campaign, so we're going to treat this with extreme caution. So I think that's to be lauded. These kind of border incidents, of course, happen. It's not that they don't happen. It's not that they didn't happen under previous governments, but it's just a question of how it's spun. And here, yes, he tries to spin it as I'm the tough guy. I'm going to be tough with Pakistan. And by the way, on the other side, on the Bangladesh side, with the question of who can vote in elections, so trying to issue a sort of database of Indian citizens, making that an issue. Because, of course, these borders are porous. They've been porous for a long time. You have people coming in from other countries. People leave India, too, going to those countries as well all the time. So the question of who could vote and who couldn't vote became, at a certain point, a very political issue. And in fact, where he made it a political issue in the state of Assam, the BJP seems to have done very well.
What about his main rival electorally, Rahul Gandhi, who hails from the biggest Indian dynasty, political dynasty, tracing his birth all the way back to India's first prime minister, but also presiding over a party, the Congress party, that has just become increasingly unpopular in India. Did Rahul Gandhi present, and by the way, he's no relation to Mahatma Gandhi, present any real challenge to Modi's message? Why did he fail so spectacularly?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to talk a little bit about the post-truth politics again, because I think there's a distinction between what Rahul Gandhi has done in the past 3-4 years as a campaigner, which is to progress. I mean, if you see his speeches now and compare them with the speeches 5 years ago, he's really become a much better politician. So I think he's learned from his mistakes. I think he's trying to build alliances. I think he and Congress in general didn't build enough alliances with left parties and other parties. There could have been a serious, anti-Modi coalition. But that would have had to have been built, a year or two ago. And instead they were trying to piece together something at the last minute, and it didn't really work. So as a result, the anti-fascist forces were kind of divided. I think that's one lesson. The other lesson, I think, is that the Congress party, like a lot of post-liberation parties, so you can look at the FLN in Algeria or similar parties. Here in South Africa, we have the African National Congress. These parties tend to have a similar trajectory in that they start with all this revolutionary zeal, and then they sort of move towards the center and become more neoliberal, more mainstream. And I think that Congress will have to reinvent itself after this election. I think that they've really lost any kind of hold they may have had in Indian society, perhaps as a result of that triangulation, perhaps as a result of that centrism. But also, I mean, India is a country, and you mentioned Mahatma Gandhi, India is a country that still has this sort of cult of personality, a desire by ordinary people to sort of worship, is not exactly the right word, but almost worship their political leaders. And, Rahul Gandhi does not fit in that mold at all. And someone like me or you, we may find that admirable, that he doesn't fit that cult of personality status. But it's not going to get the job done in electoral politics.
Right. Modi essentially has been building this cult of personality in a very systematic way. And one of the things that, and there are some analogies, of course, to be drawn with the United States, not to be too reductive, but one can sort of see the Congress party as India's Democratic Party, the BJP as India's Republican Party, and Modi as India's Trump, because he was an early adopter of social media. He was able to get his message across to particularly Indian millennials, which helped him win his first election in 2014. And the BJP is also very well funded and very adequately and adeptly used social media, I understand, for this re-election campaign, which may explain some of the millennial support behind Modi, right?
Yeah, that's definitely true. But there's also, I would say, a cross between Trump and David Duke. I mean, the the ideology that Modi represents, the ideology that Modi represents is really more akin to the ideology of the Ku Klux Klan, of the KKK, than of anything even that Donald Trump might represent, right? It's specifically a politics of hate. It's specifically a politics of almost certainly xenophobia, certainly Islamophobia. And it's really, you can look at other sort of fascist movements that have drawn, including the Nazis, by the way, that have drawn from that ideology, that Hindutva ideology, to create their own ideology, their own sort of racist ideology in the case of Nazis. In the case of Hindutva, it's not racism, but casteism that's at the core, and a certain kind of patriarchy. I mean, one of the most awful elections that I thought happened, one of the most awful results of this election, rather, is that in Delhi, a cricketer called, cricket is a game that I don't know if your viewers would be familiar with, but
it's India's baseball. Sure.
India's baseball, yeah. So a cricketer who is a retired cricketer just became a politician 2 weeks ago, and he has no experience at all. And he defeated a woman who was one of a rising young politicians who was promising, who ran on a campaign of free education for all. This guy ran on basically no platform at all. And in order to smear her, the BJP put out rumors that, she was basically, she had a bad character and she was sleeping around, this kind of stuff. So this is the kind of propaganda that was used through social media and other ways to discredit, some very good candidates and to put in people who have no idea what they're doing. Frankly, I mean, I don't know if that guy would even show up in parliament when it's his time to go. I mean, maybe he'll show up half the time. So
this is huge, because you have this through our conversation, a running theme has been fake news, the post-truth era, the role of social media. There was an investigation around whether Cambridge Analytica played a role in the last election to help Modi win, the very same firm that, is linked to Brexit and President Trump winning election here in the United States. And so this rise in right-wing authoritarianism in countries like the US, like India, like Brazil, like some European nations, like the Philippines, do you see a common thread where because information is so easily available and it's so easy to get misinformation into the hands of voters to twist their sense of reality and to push these nationalist views and often very, very xenophobic views, that we're seeing this very vicious, perfect storm of our communications era with the rise of this right-wing leadership?
I think that's absolutely right, but I think there's another element to it, which is the failure of the previous generation of leadership. I mean, I think I think it's just part of human nature that when we are desperate, when we are struggling to survive, when we see our kids have a lower standard of living than we had 30 or 40 years ago, you get the tendency towards tribalism, the tendency towards communitarianism, the tendency towards majoritarianism increases. And therefore leaders like Duterte, like Modi, like Bolsonaro in Brazil, they can have a mass appeal when, frankly, a lot of what they say, I mean, certainly Bolsonaro and Modi, a lot of what they say is just prima facie appalling, right? It would not have been acceptable a generation ago for an Indian politician to talk like Modi talks now, right? So I think there's something about the more centrist governments, the equivalent of the Democrats in the US, did not deliver what they should have delivered. And as a result, people are getting more and more desperate, and people they become easier prey for con artists like Modi, who, let's be honest, who are the real victims? The real victims are not Muslims or minorities. The real victims are everyone, because they're not pursuing policies that will benefit the majority. They're pursuing policies that will benefit a tiny minority of elites, whether those are economic policies or casteist policies or patriarchal policies, whatever they may be. They're benefiting elites. They're not benefiting the majority, although they're able to use the politics of majoritarianism to get political support.
So finally, what do you expect the next 5 years in India to look like in broad strokes under Modi's new term? He has already, in a way, this election emboldens him, which is a frightening thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I unfortunately, there's a story that's just breaking that a bomb has gone off outside a mosque in Assam, I believe. I'm not able to give the details of that story at the moment, but it's unfolding. So we can expect that those kind of incidents, I don't believe anyone's injured though. We can expect that those kind of incidents will increase, probably from both sides, because what happens when a community feels targeted, like the Muslim community will definitely feel targeted after these votes, they will also become more militant and they will be more prone to terrorist attacks and so on. So, you know, one can expect an escalation of violence, and one can expect that escalation of violence to actually cement support for this right wing, right? Because these folks, they talk like army leaders. They talk like in this jingoistic, nationalistic, militaristic voice. So when violence increases, actually they get more power. And in fact, one would argue that the right-wing Muslims and the right-wing Hindus might be in league with each other, because when they act, they give each other power, right? So that's what we can expect. I mean, the hope is that you know, the Indian community as a whole will not fall for that, will not fall into that trap, and will unite to create a kind of civil society opposition. But frankly, you know, that was my hope maybe 2 or 3 days ago. I'm afraid the dream is turning into a nightmare today. And I see the nightmare scenario as far more likely than any hopeful one.
Well, given what you were saying earlier about Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan not taking Modi's bait earlier this year on the foreign policy front, with Modi in power for another 5 years, we may very possibly see a bigger escalation between two nuclear powers, right? I mean, this is also a huge possibility.
You know, I don't think so. Maybe not until the next election cycle. I mean, because there are disputes. I mean, Kashmir is a legitimate dispute, but they've been procrastinating on Kashmir for two generations or more, for a long, long time. So I don't think that anything is likely to come to a head. Something could come to a head within Indian Kashmir itself. That's a different story. But I don't see India and Pakistan tensions rising per se, at least until the next elections, when it could be, you know, when again you could have some border conflicts that are blown out of proportion in order to fuel a certain narrative.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Samir, give out a website where people can find out more about the work that you do.
Sure. People can go to peacevigil.net, and there we have lots of videos and tools that promote peace in India, South Africa, and the US.
And that's peacevigil.net. Samir, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Samir Dosani, co-founder of peacevigil.net, a website that designs tools to promote peace. In fact, Samir also holds a master's degree in women's studies from La Trobe University in Australia, where his thesis focused on the role of religious sectarianism in undermining women's rights in India. We've been discussing the results of India's recent elections. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can subscribe to our daily newsletter. Also, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes and our video channel on Vimeo.